Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Israel Prime Minister says Hamas is committing war crimes and suspected U.S. drone strikes kill 15 in Pakistan. I'm Bob Doty reporting from Washington. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Hamas militants in Gaza are committing war crimes by directly targeting millions of Israeli civilians with rocket fire and by using their own civilians as human shields. Speaking at a news conference Wednesday, Mr. Netanyahu also blamed Hamas' rejection of an Egyptian-proposed ceasefire for Israel's decision to fight back through its campaigns of airstrikes against militants firing rockets at Israel.
Hamas thus shut the door to a diplomatic solution, and it therefore bears the sole responsibility for the continuation of the violence.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is due to meet in Cairo with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to discuss how to successfully implement the Egyptian proposed ceasefire. Israel accepted the plan on Tuesday and held fire for about 6 hours before resuming airstrikes. Hamas told Cairo it officially rejected the proposal Wednesday. Israel's military Wednesday warned tens of thousands of residents in northern Gaza to leave their homes until further notice, as it struck dozens of sites, including the home of senior Hamas leader Mahmoud Zahar. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has been sworn in for a new 7-year term following an election the opposition and its Western allies have dismissed as a sham. He took the oath of office Wednesday during a ceremony at the presidential palace in Damascus, attended by members of the country's parliament. Last month, Mr. Assad won a landslide election held only in government-controlled areas. Speaking at the ceremony, Mr. Assad warned that Western and Arab nations that supported what he called terrorists would pay a high price. Western and Arab nations have given money and equipment to help opposition fighters during Syria's nearly 3.5-year civil war. Pakistani officials say as many as 4 U.S. drone strikes have killed at least 15 people in the country's northwest tribal region. Authorities say the strikes took place in the town of Dattakhel in North Waziristan. The identity and nationality of those killed was not immediately known. U.S. drone attacks have been a source of tension between the two countries, with Pakistan claiming the strikes are a violation of its sovereignty. The Philippine government is focused on cleaning up debris after a strong typhoon cut across the northern island of Luzon Wednesday, affecting the capital and killing at least 10 people and forcing the evacuation of hundreds of thousands. From Manila, Simone Orendine reports.
Typhoon Ramasun blew from the southeast corner of Luzon to the Manila capital region on Wednesday with winds between 150 and 185 kilometers per hour. Its gusts knocked out power, tore roofs off houses, and uprooted trees, leaving piles of broken branches and downed power lines on the roads. Philippine civil defense officials say close to 400,000 people living in vulnerable areas or along waterways were affected. Schools, government, and private businesses were shuttered. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Manila.
Russian authorities have detained 2 Moscow subway workers over the fatal subway derailment that killed at least 21 people and injured over 150 others. Russia's major investigative agency says senior Moscow roadmaster of railway service, Valery Bashkatov, and his assistant, Yuri Gordov, have been questioned. Authorities are preparing to formally charge them with safety breaches. The investigative committee says the cause of the crash was an improperly installed rail switch and the snapping of a single 3-millimeter wire. The United States deported 38 children and their mothers to Honduras this week in the first of what it promises will be regular flights sending illegal Central American immigrants back to their homelands. But the U.S. is finding it difficult to cope with the growing influx of thousands of children, sometimes with their mothers, sometimes alone, who are making the long and dangerous trip from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador in search of a better life in the U.S. An immigration law expert, Anna Shavers, at the University of Nebraska, told VOA the country is questioning whether it can accommodate the thousands who are showing up on its doorstep. That's the news. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A new report by UNAIDS says it is possible to end the AIDS epidemic by 2030 if millions of marginalized people can get life-saving treatment for HIV.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva, where a report is being launched in advance of next week's International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Nigerian security forces have taken custody of a former Army intelligence officer who is accused of masterminding a bombing in the capital. And the government of Mali and rebel groups begin meetings today in Algiers to hash out a final peace arrangement.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Kenya, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Nigerian security forces have taken custody of a former Army intelligence officer who is accused of masterminding a bombing in the capital that killed dozens of people. Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja.
In the early hours of April 14th, the Nyanya bus station on the outskirts of Abuja was filled with commuters headed to the center of town for work when two bombs detonated. At least 71 people were killed and hundreds more injured. The blasts were the first in the capital in 2 years, and by far the most deadly in the city's history. Nigerian security forces arrested 5 suspects in May, saying 2 others, the masterminds, were at large. State Security Services spokesperson Marilyn Auger says one of those suspects, Aminu Sadiq Oguche, was returned to Nigeria on Tuesday.
Security forces took delivery of Aminu Sadiq Oguche, who has been extradited from the Sudanese government and has been taken into custody by security forces. Investigation is going to continue, and I think very soon he will be charged to court also.
Oguche is the British-born son of a retired Nigerian army colonel. He has previously been arrested on terrorism-related charges. Officials say the arrest is a major win for the Nigerian security forces, which have been criticized heavily for failing to rescue more than 200 girls kidnapped in the north on the same day as the Nyanya bombing. Militant group Boko Haram claimed responsibility for the bombing and the kidnapping of the girls. The group says it wants to impose a strict version of Islamic law on Nigeria and has been blamed for thousands of deaths this year alone. Since the Nyanya bombing, 2 other bombings in Abuja have claimed dozens of lives and raised fears that Boko Haram's reach is expanding beyond the northeast, where 3 states have been under emergency rule for more than a year. This is Nigeria National Information Center coordinator Mike Omeri.
Fight against insurgency and the effort to get our girls back is top priority of the government of Nigeria. Besides that, this is also evident that the armed forces of Nigeria and security services and all agencies are working hard to put this thing behind us as a nation.
Another alleged mastermind of the bombing, Rufai Abubakar Siga, remains missing, and the Nigerian government has offered a $150,000 reward for information leading to his arrest. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
The Mali government and rebel groups begin meeting today in Algiers to hash out a final peace arrangement a year after returning to democracy. The talks, which include African mediators, come amid this month's escalation of violence in the north in violation of a May ceasefire. Meanwhile, French President François Hollande is expected in West Africa later this week to flesh out his new counter-terrorism strategy in the Sahel, which will replace the current French troop presence in northern Mali. Catherine Hayat in Bamako reports.
Violent clashes and suicide attacks continue to plague northern Mali. This despite French military intervention, elections and international mediation following a 2012 military coup which led to the country being torn apart by separatists. In May, Mali's army suffered an embarrassing defeat at the hands of Tuareg separatists after an attempt to seize their stronghold Kidal. Last week, More than 35 people were killed in clashes between the MNLA rebels, the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad, and the MAA, the Arab Movement of Azawad. On Monday, a suicide attack against the French army patrol killed one soldier and injured six. The talks in Algeria are the first real effort to bring Mali's factions together to draw a roadmap on how to resolve differences. President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita has signaled he is willing to compromise, but has ruled out any final deal which threatens Mali's territorial integrity or secularism. To underscore this, Al-Qaeda-linked Islamist separatist groups, which occupied northern Mali in 2012 before being ousted by a French military offensive, have been excluded from negotiations. Mediators from the African Union, the AU, among other African groups, will be facilitating these difficult talks. Issa Kasuare, the special advisor to the head of the AU mission, tells VOA he's optimistic.
The African Union, in conjunction with other regional ECOWAS, UN, the European Union, others, in conjunction with these actors, will do everything it can to ensure that we reach a conclusive agreement at the end of this process.
Meanwhile, France has announced an end to its 18-month military operation known as Saval, which effectively reunited Mali, but has not completely stabilized it. It will be replaced by a broader anti-terrorism operation in the Sahel region. The new operation, called Barkhane, will involve security cooperation with Niger, Chad, Mali and other border nations. It will see some 3,000 French soldiers deployed, with at least a third of them remaining in northern Mali. It will also see France assist with drones, fighter jets and other military hardware. Alain Antil heads the Sub-Saharan Africa program for the French Institute for International Relations in Paris.
La mission Barkhane va donner un peu de cohérence à la présence de troupes françaises qui sont déjà présentes.
He says Operation Barkhane uses French troops already in Mauritania, Mali, Niger and Burkina Faso. He says the new operation will give coherence to the French military presence in the Sahel and to the regional fight against terrorism. French President François Hollande heads to West Africa Thursday with stops in Niger and Chad to hold talks with his counterparts on the operation. Catherine Haye for VOA News, Bamako.
A new report by UNAIDS says it is possible to end the AIDS epidemic by 2030 if millions of marginalized people can get life-saving treatment for HIV. The report finds new HIV infections are at their lowest level this century, and AIDS-related deaths have fallen by one-third since 2005. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, where the report is being launched in advance of next week's International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia.
The new UN report finds tremendous progress is being made in reducing the number of new HIV infections and in keeping more people with HIV/AIDS alive. It estimates that at the end of last year, 35 million people globally were living with HIV. 2.1 million were newly infected, and 1.5 million had died from AIDS-related illnesses. Sub-Saharan Africa has the highest number of people living with HIV, followed by people in the Asia-Pacific region. The report says nearly 13 million people with HIV have access to antiretroviral treatment. But it notes millions more are denied access to these life-saving drugs because they are marginalized, criminalized, or suffer from discrimination. They include men who have sex with men, transgender people, sex workers, prisoners, and injected drug users. The report shows these people are among 19 million of the 35 million people living with HIV today who do not know they have the virus. So, says UNAIDS Executive Director Michel Sidibe, they will not seek treatment, and this will impede efforts to bring the HIV/AIDS epidemic under control.
There will be no end to the AIDS epidemic if we don't put people first and close the gap. This report gives the best data possible on people being left behind. If the 19 million people who are living with HIV don't find out their status, they will die. But if they do, they will access treatment and live full and healthy lives.
Dr. Sidibe says the world will be on track to end the epidemic by 2030 if antiretroviral treatment for millions of HIV-positive people is scaled up by 2020. But entire countries are being left behind and are facing the triple threat of high HIV burden, low treatment coverage, and no or little decline in new HIV infections. The report shows 15 countries account for more than 75% of the global burden of new HIV infections. Three countries in sub-Saharan Africa, Nigeria, South Africa, and Uganda, account for 48% of all new HIV infections. Dr. Sidibe tells VOA these countries are not progressing for several reasons.
You take countries like, I said, the Central African Republic, you have only 14% of coverage. Countries with war, countries with a lack of a governance system, all health system not existing, collapse, and others. But you have Democratic Republic of Congo. Again, a major challenge, as you know, governance, issues of war, post-war, and difficulties to really reach all.
The report shows African countries are not alone in facing problems. For example, it notes HIV infections are high in the Russian Federation because people who inject drugs are marginalized and do not get the services they need. The United States is cited for its high rate of HIV infections, placing it among the top 15 countries in the world. This, the report says, is mainly due to certain critical groups, such as black women and men who have sex with men, being left behind. The report says the key to ending the AIDS epidemic lies in focusing on helping populations that are underserved and at higher risk of HIV get the treatment they need. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Amihis Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Nigerian security forces have taken custody of a former army intelligence officer who is accused of masterminding a bombing in the capital. And the government of Mali and rebel groups begin meetings today in Algiers to hash out a final peace arrangement. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Well, Yahya's Kenyan opposition leader Raila Odinga is accusing the government of failing to safeguard the nation following violent attacks on civilians on the nation's coast. Odinga says President Uhuru Kenyatta is using the security crisis to attack political adversaries. Odinga is a former prime minister and leader of the Coalition for Reforms and Democracy. He ran for president in the last election and was defeated by Mr. Kenyatta. More than 80 civilians from villages in Lamu County have died in raids by armed gunmen in recent weeks. Somali terrorists have claimed responsibility, but Mr. Kenyatta had denied involvement by the Al-Shabaab group. The president blames local political networks for the violent attacks. Some Kenyans see Mr. Kenyatta's explanation for the violence as an attack on Odinga and his political allies.
Some Muslim leaders in Kenya's coastal city of Mombasa have called on security officials not to harass worshippers at the Musa Mosque in Majengo. The mosque has been a magnet for police surveillance because of suspected radicalism and connections to the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. Mohammed Yusuf has the story from Mombasa.
The drive to Musa Mosque in the neighborhood of Majengo takes a little longer these days. Due to heightened concern about security, motorists and pedestrians try to avoid the mosque in general. Inside, there are few worshippers. It is quite a contrast to the days when the mosque was so full. Many had to pray on the streets outside. Musa long had a reputation of attracting young men due to what many describe as a more liberal and intellectual open atmosphere. It is that same reputation which attracted authorities to scrutinize those preaching for radical content. Now the young avoid the mosque due to fears they will be caught in another security crackdown or being labeled terrorist sympathizers. Noor Abdallah, a 25-year-old Majengo resident, is one of them. He says he stopped praying in the mosque after a police raid, which left some people dead. He says he's too afraid it could happen again, and he'll be caught up in it. That raid was in February. Kenyan security forces killed 3 people and arrested more than 100 young people, most of whom were later released by the courts. But in that raid, Kenyan security forces said they recovered an AK-47 rifle, knives, video disc and flags, which bore the symbols of Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. Kenyan authorities allege some of the Musa Mosque clerics are recruiting for Al-Shabaab among the poor young men in the rundown neighborhood of Majengo. Sheikh Jumangao, the chairman of Kenya's Muslim National Advisory Council, argues worshippers should not be harassed because of a few individuals who are suspected of preaching hate and violence.
People who are performing prayers in the Musa Mosque should not at any given time be harassed. Even if there is one suspect or two in that mosque, it's not a reason to the government or the police to go and harass Muslims in that mosque. What they must do first, they must do their investigation before taking an action like the way they did in the previous time.
Local human rights organizations have accused Kenyan police of using heavy-handed tactics against the Muslim community, including forced disappearances and murder. Police have strongly denied the accusations and say their actions are in defense of a nation under attack from militants both inside the country and in neighboring Somalia. Abdallah says families feel they are no longer safe and some are leaving Majengo altogether. He says it is very sad to see how empty the mosque is during the holy month of Ramadan, which is a time when people especially love to go to mosque. He says even people who lived around the mosque have moved, leaving empty houses behind. Sheikh Ngao says in the past 4 months, clerics and local human rights groups have been trying to work with the mosque leadership and young worshippers there to ensure that radicalism is not part of the culture, and to allay fears within border Kenya.
They were ready to quit their understanding about jihad and join the other side of the Muslim clerics and forge forward and march forward with their mission of peace.
Ngao says the message of peace needs time to sink in and the support of the holy teachers so young people can truly understand their religion in Musa and elsewhere. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Mombasa.
Well, Kenyan police discovered more than 340 kilograms of heroin hidden on a large cargo ship in the port of Mombasa yesterday. Anti-narcotics officials arrested 9 suspects aboard the stateless vessel when they detained the ship last week. The stash of heroin was discovered in the diesel tanks of the MV Bushehr Amandaria several days after an initial discovery of 900 grams of heroin hidden among bags of cement. Officials are continuing a search of the vessel. Kenya is working with security agencies in Pakistan, India, and Iran to locate the ship's owners. The detained crew included 5 Pakistanis, 2 Indians, and an Iranian. Smuggling of heroin from Pakistan and Iran to Europe has increased in recent years. East Africa's porous coast make it a popular route to major European markets. An Australian war vessel seized a ton of heroin with a market value of $268 million aboard a Dhow sailing in Kenyan waters 3 months ago.
French President François Hollande flies to Africa tomorrow on a 3-nation visit that will focus on economic issues and rooting out terrorism in the Sahel area. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more on the trip from Paris.
Security tops the agenda of President François Hollande's trip to Africa, where he'll visit French troops and hold talks with leaders of Niger, Chad, and Ivory Coast. France has just announced a new mission to fight jihadists in the Sahel area. The operation is called Barkhane, named after a type of sand dune. Alain Onti heads a sub-Saharan African program for the French Institute for International Relations in Paris.
La mission Barkhane va donner un peu de cohérence à la présence de troupes françaises qui sont déjà présentes.
Onti notes that Barkhane makes use of French troops already in Mauritania, Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. He says the new operation will give coherence to the French military presence in the Sahel and to the regional fight against terrorism. Roughly 3,000 French military personnel will be involved, including about 1,200 troops who took part in the offensive against Islamists in northern Mali. On Monday, a French soldier was killed in a suicide attack near the city of Gao, underscoring the security concerns.
Les soldats français présents au Niger et l'armée nigérienne.
Analyst Antil says regional countries like Niger cooperate closely with France in security matters, but he says it's important for other players, including European countries, to be more involved. In Ivory Coast, Mr. Hollande will focus on trade and investment issues in a country whose economy has rebounded after a long civil war. In Chad, Mr. Hollande's last stop and where the Sahel operation will be based, human rights activists fear rights issues might take a back seat to security matters.
C'est-à-dire que les différents présidents, ils arrivent avec des bonnes idées.
Antil predicts Mr. Hollande will pay lip service to human rights. The socialist president promised a new relationship with Africa when he was elected. But Antil says that, like other French leaders, he's become more pragmatic in office. For African countries, even Francophone ones, France's star is fading in favor of new players like China and India. But Mr. Hollande, who launched missions in Mali and the Central African Republic, has earned respect and even popularity in some parts of the continent, the kind of support that eludes him back home in France. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
In Egypt, seven men have been sentenced to life in prison for sexually assaulting women during rallies in Tahrir Square. The Associated Press reports these are the first tough sentences handed out by a court after the government promised to crack down on sexual violence. The charges stem from four separate incidents. One attack occurred during celebrations following the inauguration of President al-Sisi in June. Two other defendants were sentenced to 2 20-year terms each.
Five emerging economic powers announced yesterday that they have agreed to build their own development bank. It will be called the New Development Bank. The BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, say they'll make an initial investment of $100 billion. Their new bank would vie with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to serve the development needs of the world's poor. Representatives of the bank's founding countries announced tentative plans to establish the bank's headquarters in Hong Kong with a regional office in a yet-to-be-identified South African city.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there is a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Nigerian security forces have taken custody of a former army intelligence officer who was accused of masterminding a bombing in the capital. And the government of Mali and rebel groups begin meetings today in Algiers to hash out a final peace arrangement. Coming up, we have music from Kenya. And in our feature segment, we go to Zimbabwe, where the majority of civil servants are men. The government is taking measures to address gender imbalance. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have lots of African football news for us this evening.
Lots on the plate, Kim. And joining us once again from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, with the World Cup now over, African football fans can look forward to another big weekend of qualifying matches for the 2015 Nations Cup in Morocco. How about some details?
Right, Sonny, let's look at those fixtures first. They're the third round, first leg qualifying matches for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, which will be hosted by Morocco. And just a reminder, we have mentioned this before on the Sunny Side of Sport, that the winners of these seven matches, they will go forward to the group stage. We already have 21 teams who've received byes, and these seven teams will bring the total up to 28, and those matches will begin in September. This coming Saturday, Sunny, we've got three matches. In Kampala, we've got Uganda against Mauritania. In Gaborone, we've got Botswana against Guinea-Bissau. And in Freetown, we've got Sierra Leone against the Seychelles. Now, if we just look quickly at those matches before we go on to the Sunday fixtures, Uganda, they have not been at the Nations Cup since 1978. That year, they reached the final against the host Ghana and lost 2-0. That's an incredibly long time for the Cranes of Uganda not to have made the Nations Cup. Now, they didn't particularly impress Sunny in the previous qualifying round. In fact, they scraped past Madagascar on the away goal rule. The Ugandans lost 2-1 away and won 1-0 in Kampala, so it finished 2-2, and Uganda advanced on the away goal rule. Now, a lot of people might be puzzled by the fact that I said Uganda are playing Mauritania, because they will remember on the previous edition, Sonny, we said that the draw meant Uganda would play Equatorial Guinea. What's happened during the World Cup is that it's been found by CAF that Equatorial Guinea fielded an ineligible player in their victory over Mauritania, and therefore the Equatorial Guineans have been disqualified and Mauritania have been restored to the competition. Uganda with home advantage, Sonny, they've got to win to have any chance of making the group stage, and I predict that they will win. Botswana warmed up for their match against Guinea-Bissau with a 4-2 friendly victory over Tanzania, and that will cheer their English coach, Peter Butler, no end, because a big problem for Botswana in the last couple of years has been goal scoring. Guinea-Bissau are a bit of an unknown quantity. They beat the Central African Republic 3-1 on aggregate in the previous round. But as with Uganda, Botswana will be favoured to build an advantage playing at home. The match that looks the most one-sided, Sonny, of the Saturday fixtures is Sierra Leone against the Seychelles. The Seychelles have been in Uganda preparing for this match, and they got a 5-1 hiding from the Ugandans in one friendly game, but obviously improved their defensive structures because they played again a few days later, and this time it was just 1-0 for Uganda. Nevertheless, Sierra Leone are ranked among the top 20 teams in Africa. Seychelles tend to be one of the whipping boys, And therefore, I'm predicting a Sierra Leone victory, probably with a couple of goals to spare. If we then move on to Sunday, Sonny, there's another four fixtures. At Maseru, it's Lesotho against Kenya. At Dar es Salaam, it's Tanzania against Mozambique. At Pointe Noire in Congo, it's Congo-Brazzaville against Rwanda. And at Cotonou, it's Benin against Malawi. Lesotho, they surprised Liberia in the previous round, while Kenya were not particularly impressive. They scraped past the Comore Islands 2-1 in aggregate. So that's an intriguing match. And let me just advise the Kenyans to come with their warmest kit, Sonny. At this time of year in Lesotho, it gets extremely cold, even in mid-afternoon when the match is scheduled to start. It's likely to be a lot warmer up on the east coast of Africa in Dar es Salaam. Tanzania will be looking to build a first-leg lead over Mozambique. In the previous round, the teams had contrasting fortunes, Tanzania scraping past Zimbabwe 3-2 on aggregate, while Mozambique hammered newcomers South Sudan by 5-0. Pointe Noire is a tough place to survive, and Rwanda will go there to face Congo Brazzaville. Now, the Congolese are coached by Claude Leroy. He's that veteran French coach, and Sonny, what he doesn't know about African football is not really worth knowing anything about. The Rwandans, on the other hand, they've got their new coach, Stephen Constantine. Now, he got off to a wonderful start when his team hammered Libya 3-0 in Kigali. So the Rwandans will go to Congo with a reasonable amount of optimism. And the interesting thing is that the winners of that tie, Sonny, will go into a group that includes Nigeria, if their suspension by FIFA is lifted, South Africa and Sudan. So there's a lot to play for there. And finally, in Cotonou in West Africa, Malawi are going to have to improve their away form if they're going to get a good result against Benin. Now, Benin beat Sao Tome 2-0 at home and 2-0 away. And three of those 4 goals came from Stéphane Sessegnon. He's a midfielder who plays for West Bromwich Albion in the English Premier League. When Malawi went to Chad in the previous round, they got a 3-1 hiding, but scraped through on the away goal rule. The return matches, Sonny, are due for August 1, 2, or 3. And those 7 winners on aggregate will join 21 teams who've received byes. So you've got 28 teams divided by 4. You've got 7 groups. Winners and runners-up qualify automatically for Morocco, and also the best of the third-place teams. And that can often be really interesting when you get to the final rounds of the groups. And those group matches will be played in September, October, and November.
David, I know you said the Sierra Leone-Seychelles match in Freetown could be the most one-sided of the Saturday fixtures. And you're predicting a Sierra Leone victory, probably with a couple of goals to spare. Well, we might possibly see a tighter scoreline in Freetown based on the breaking turmoil in Sierra Leone football. Team captain Ibrahim Kargbo and 3 other players, Ibrahim Karoma, Samuel Barley, and Christian Kalker, have been suspended indefinitely over allegations of match-fixing relating to a 2008 Nations Cup qualifier against South Africa, which ended scoreless. In addition, 3 referees and 8 officials have been suspended. In a joint statement, Sports Minister Paul Kamara and Sierra Leone Football Association President Isha Johansson said they received credible and tangible information about the alleged involvement of the players, referees, and officials. Now, one of the officials named Rodney Michael was controversially disqualified from running for FA president last year. Michael told Reuters news agency the suspension was a witch hunt. Joining us now with more African football news is our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Kenya's Harambee Stars and Burundi Swallows play to a scoreless draw in Nairobi on Tuesday. The match is a build-up for both teams as they prepare for their 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers this coming weekend. In Uganda, the hosts Uganda Cranes and Malawi also play to a scoreless draw on Tuesday. Earlier on, Uganda pipped Seychelles 1-0 also in Kampala. Meanwhile, the local organizing committee chairman for the 2015 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia, Alexei Sorokin, reckons that they will not only match but actually surpass the quality of organization of football's greatest spectacle in 4 years. Sorokin made these revelations in Rio de Janeiro at the end of the just concluded 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil. Turning to swimming, Zimbabwe's most accomplished Olympian, Kirsty Coventry, has moved to Charlotte, North Carolina in the United States of America. Voice of America! To begin her training for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics. She says she'll miss her family and friends. However, after getting married, she says she has settled well in her new training camp and hopes to do Zimbabwe proud at the next Olympic Games.
If you were to talk to us from the deepest better part of the bottom of your heart. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
And my Voice of America colleague, Shaka Sali, will be waiting for you later Wednesday evening at 18:30 UTC with another edition of Straight Talk Africa. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. And let's give a special Sunny Side of Sports shout-out for Celestine Ibebuike, who sent me a tweet from Onitsha, Nigeria. Celestine tweets, I love your program, especially as it concerns African football. Thanks for listening in Onitsha, Celestine Ibebuike. In pro basketball news, star guard Dwayne Wade has re-signed with the Miami Heat. It's a 2-year deal, and while financial details were not released, it's expected D. Wade's salary for next season will not reach the $20 million he would have made under his previous contract. Meanwhile, another veteran star, Germany's Dirk Nowitzki, has re-signed with the Dallas Mavericks. The 36-year-old Nowitzki received a 3-year, $30 million contract. Our VOA basketball fans will remember Nowitzki played against Dwayne Wade in the 2011 NBA Finals. Nowitzki was named the finals' most valuable player as the Mavericks beat the Heat 4-2. Nowitzki is also a 12-time NBA All-Star, and he was named the NBA's most valuable player in 2007. And both he and Dwayne Wade will almost certainly be inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame after their great careers come to an end. I'm taking a break from the sports beat until July 28th. Peter Clotie will be behind our sporty VOA microphone in my absence. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahya's Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on The Voice of America.
In our feature segment, in Zimbabwe, where the majority of civil servants are men, the government is taking measures to address gender imbalance. And next, Amnesty International criticizes Europe's crackdown on illegal immigration. But first, some music. Here is Amani of Kenya with Move On.
Thank you.
Amani of Kenya with Move On.
In Zimbabwe, the Civil Service Commission says the government is taking measures to address gender imbalance among its 300,000 workforce, where the majority of civil servants are men. Reporter Erwin Chifara has details from Harare.
Commissioner Stephen Ngwenya, who was standing in for Chairperson Maria Wandanzua, told Parliament's Women Affairs, Gender and Community Development Portfolio Committee that the civil service has 145,511 male employees compared to 134,699 females. Ngwenya said the commission is now taking measures to ensure that gender equality and balance is addressed as enshrined in the new constitution.
Whenever we are interviewing people for promotion posts, even way down to the ministries, we emphasize that if it's neck and neck with men, a woman will be given first preference, not that the man will be discarded.
Ngwenya, however, said affirmative action for unqualified women is not good for women and Zimbabwe's civil service. He noted that most discrepancies in the civil service management was largely because senior employees in most parts of the country were not keen to leave their spouses and families and take up management posts in Harare, where most of them are positioned.
People from Mutare, from Bulawayo, from Gwanda, from Binga don't want to come to Harare, especially female members of. And not long ago, we interviewed people for chief accountants. There were three ladies who qualified from Bulawayo. They came to Harare. And when the time came for them to be interviewed, they said, unless you're going to create these posts in Bulawayo, sorry, we can't leave our families out there.
Out of the 29 permanent secretaries in the civil service, 20 are men and only 9 are women. Out of the 587 management positions in the civil service, only 241 are occupied by females and the rest by men. Ngwenya urged parliamentarians to encourage women in their constituencies to apply for posts in the civil service so that the commission can achieve gender equality and balance. Responding to committee chairperson Beata Nyampinga's complaints that there was abuse and discrimination against women when it came to promotions in the civil service, Ngwenya said this is now being done by a committee of no less than 6 officials from different government departments, but under the supervision of the Civil Service Commission. Ngwenya said those found violating civil service regulations will be punished. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Rights group Amnesty International claims Europe is cracking down on illegal immigration, which is costly and closes the doors to refugees fleeing conflict. Lisa Bryan has more from Paris.
A new report by Amnesty International claims measures adopted by European governments to staunch illegal immigration are not only costing taxpayers billions of dollars, but are creating new dangers for Syrians and others seeking refuge from conflict. Yizzar Kadtigani is Deputy Director of Amnesty's Europe and Central Asia program.
The European Union is making its utmost to protect its borders and has built a fortress Europe, but the cost of all of this is actually the human rights violations of migrants and refugees trying to reach Europe and taking very dangerous journeys to reach the continent.
According to Amnesty, the European Union spent about $2.8 billion protecting its external borders between 2007 and 2013. Amnesty says the 28-member bloc spent less than a third of that amount to improve conditions for refugees and asylum seekers within its borders. The report, Tigani says, aims to raise public awareness.
Trying as well to make Europeans to think about, you know, what is happening at their doorstep, you know, what is happening at their borders, and what are their governments doing not to allow people who are in need of international protection.
New statistics show nearly 500,000 people applied for asylum in the European Union last year, the highest number recorded since the bloc began collecting data 6 years ago. Many refugees from the Middle East and North Africa make a perilous journey across the Mediterranean to reach Europe's doors. Earlier this week, EU Home Affairs Commissioner Cecilia Malmström urged member nations to take in more Syrians and other asylum seekers.
There is a strong emphasis on assisting Syrians at the moment, but there are also other countries that would need support. And people do embark on rickety vessels on very dangerous travels because there are very few, if any, legal ways to get to Europe. And one way to come to Europe in a safe way would be through increased resettlement.
At the same time, Commissioner Malmstrom says new European laws will lead to fairer and better asylum decisions in Europe and better protection and reception for asylum seekers. But Amnesty says more needs to be done to turn legislation into action. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Mvunganyi, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is no doubt that cooperation between the United States and China will play a crucial role in resolving some of the world's most complicated issues and shaping global and regional policies over the foreseeable future. It is therefore important that our people learn to work together. But to work together effectively, we must each have a good understanding of how the other thinks and works. That is why 4 years ago, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and China's then State Counselor Liu Langdong launched the U.S.-China Consultation on People-to-People Exchange. The purpose of the initiative was, and still is, to enhance people-to-people exchanges between the citizens of the United States and China in the areas of education, culture, sports, women's issues, and science and technology. This year, the two sides agreed to add a sixth area, health. The goal at the time was to send 100,000 American students to China by 2014. Speaking at the fifth consultation on people-to-people exchange plenary session, Secretary of State John Kerry said that today we are meeting and exceeding that number. We are determined to ensure that young Americans develop a deep understanding of China. And this year, I'm proud to say, we are elevating our partnership even further by focusing on health, which is a global challenge that demands a global response. This will not be defined by numbers. It's our people, it's our students, our artists, our musicians, our athletes, our scientists coming together to lay the foundation for greater trust and eventually for greater leadership in the world. Our students right now are already laying the foundation for this transformation, said Secretary of State Kerry. The story of U.S.-China relations really can be one of genuine cooperation and, frankly, of spectacular accomplishment. And while we may disagree at times on one thing or another, I'm absolutely convinced that we can learn from the past and herald a brighter future together. If we build greater trust, if we reach for greater prosperity, if we lead together on the world stage, this consultation will be not the only one of its kind or the only partnership that our people share. It will simply be the first, and it will set an example for the possibilities of the future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Yeah! Bahungu mimi